and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Zoe Harwood. Zoe is the founder of Light Minds Collective, a compassionate and soul-centered coaching space dedicated to helping individuals heal from low self-confidence, eating disorders, and poor body image. With over 20 years of experience in mindset coaching within the dance industry and beyond, Zoe combines holistic and creative approaches to guide clients towards living with confidence, integrity, and purpose. Drawing on her own lived experience of orthorexia, which complicated her pregnancy and led to hyperemesis and a difficult delivery, Zoe now uses her journey to raise awareness of eating disorders in pregnancy and beyond, and to empower others to find food freedom and authentic self-worth. I enjoyed this conversation so much with Zoe, and it was incredible to hear her honesty around her story and her experience. I think it really highlights how brainwashed, as we say in the podcast, we have become about health and what health means. But it's incredible that Zoe is now sharing her experience so others can get the help and support that they need. Welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Zoe Harwood, which I'm very excited about. So thank you so much for joining me, Zoe. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's taken us so long to get here, hasn't it?
I was literally thinking as I was walking up the stairs to come and do this, I was like, I swear to God, I've probably known you as long as I've done this podcast. How are we only just doing this episode?
The intention was always there, absolutely, but we just could never get it to work.
I think also sometimes, you know, because I've known you for so long, it was almost just in my mind, of course we've done an episode, how would we have not done one already? So then I didn't constantly think, oh, I need to like book that episode in Mosaic. So it's like, yeah, well, of course we've done one. We like, that would be stupid if we hadn't.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's up there somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. My name is Zoe Harwood. I am now an eating disorder recovery and body image coach. I like to say in a previous life, I was a dancer from the age of 2, and I had a 20-year career in dancing. I was principal of a dance school for 20 years, and it was a family business. It was my mum's before that for 10 years. And so I think it's fair to say that when you're a dancer, you have quite a complex relationship with your body and with food. And that definitely started playing out for me from the age of about 17. Different disordered eating patterns, which then really came to blows at about the age of 27. I naturally moved into this space, I guess, because our dance school was a holistic dance school. We were really mindful that we didn't just develop the dance skill of all of our students, that it was like the emotional development and like the mental development of them as well. And we were really proud of almost being, I guess, like first in the business, really, of creating that space for dancers. And just letting people see that you don't have to miss out on the trophies and the exam results just because you don't focus purely on dance. And I love the coaching so much that I just ended up veering off and coming into this space and handing my dance school over to one of my teachers so that she could carry on the ethos. Now I'm a research associate at the University of Gloucestershire for the Body Project from lived experience angle, and we're working hopefully on the dancers adaptation for that as well, which is really exciting. Yeah, which will be useful for also for swimmers and gymnasts as well, because it's all the same messaging. That's me now.
That's amazing, and I think that's so wonderful
to use that experience that you had, that lived experience. I could really hear that ethos shining through of really wanting to make sure that people's mental health and physical health was protected. You know, I think often we hear of, as you said, you know, swimmers, gymnasts, dancers, that sporting career becomes the priority at any cost. And a lot of the time, I think particularly with things like dancing and gymnastics, your body is part of the artwork.
Yeah.
And it's very tricky to find that balance between maintaining a physique that means that you look aesthetically pleasing for what you're doing, but also making sure you're safe at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we are moving with the times a little bit, and we are beginning to help people realize that you can still see beautiful artistry and beautiful technique on anybody. Yeah. And the Royal Ballet, I think, are leading the way with that at the moment. And that's very beautiful to be watching from the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. That's incredible to hear. And
yeah,
I imagine that the body positivity movement and things like that have really helped that change in direction. And I think it does come from, you know, in order for that change to happen, you have to have like dance schools and the big organizations involved. Otherwise, the kind of expectations still exist, but the people that are trying to engage kind of, you know, have different thoughts around it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of the dance schools have been sued recently as well for damages in, you know, lifelong eating disorders and body image issues. And so I think that's part of the push of, okay, maybe we need to change the narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm really happy to hear that, actually, because I can imagine that a lot of just, you know, a lot of wonderful things come from things like dance. And I know that you've congratulated me so many times on my Instagram story, and dance has been a really big part of my recovery. But equally, I can imagine that it can cause a lot of distress and worry about food and body image. You mentioned in your introduction that you'd struggled with different types of eating disorder. I wondered if you'd mind sharing that with us.
Yeah, of course. So this is started at the age of 17. So we're talking, oh God, I'm 40 now.
I would have not guessed that you were 40. Wow. You do not look
thank
40.
You. Thank you. So I guess back then, I'd only heard of anorexia and bulimia. And I started purging my normal meals. And so I thought, well, I'm not binging and purging, so this is fine. And I had no idea that this is something that shouldn't be happening. So that went on for about 18 months. And I noticed that I started swelling in my face over that time. And so I didn't look the way that I thought I was going to look. So that slowly started disappearing. I started phasing that out, and then just spending like the next 8 years of extreme yo-yo dieting of, you know, 10, 14 days of juice diets and, oh gosh, I don't know if you remember that aloe vera diet.
Oh my God, yes, my mum did it.
Oh, it was the most horrendous thing. And I kept putting myself through it. So it's things like that, really, just quite extreme. And obviously the weight always came back. But then when I was about 27, my auntie came to us and she said, I've been put on statins. We have hereditary heart issues in our family. So we all need to watch our cholesterol. Something about that just flipped a switch in me and I freaked out. And so I went and researched like the lowest saturated fat diet that I could find and went plant-based whole foods overnight. And everything was made from scratch. And I had this mindset, if you can't grow it, don't eat it. Because I almost like had visions of my arteries clogging up if I were to eat any kind of animal product. Now, bearing in mind, I'm a Cornish girl, so fish was like my life growing up, and that was the hardest thing for me to give up. That took real gaslighting. I don't know if that's the word. So all animal products were out, and I had a real fear. My biggest fear was a heart attack and cancer. And this was around about like 2014-ish. Can you remember like the fruitarian era?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was just cutting back everything and trying to just eat fruit. And that was what I was following on social media. And all of the scaremongering of if you, you know, fruit is a healer, and if you eat anything else, then you're going to develop cancer and you're, you know, going to have heart attack. I mean, how different is that narrative around fruit now? This is how bullshit this all is. And that was a real influence on me and my relationship with food. So everything was home cooked, absolutely everything. And I'm talking down to like curry pastes and ketchup and stuff like that.
Wow.
I know, it really did go a long, long way. And it was all through fear of what would happen to my body if I didn't do that. It was never, interestingly, when the switch first happened, it wasn't about losing weight. It was about a fear of getting ill. And it wasn't until I was probably 2 years in that it then started becoming about restriction, because obviously the comments came about the weight loss and being a dancer, and that was all, you know, such an amazing thing in our industry. And so then it became about restriction as well, but it still was centered around health and, yeah, what would happen if I didn't do it.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time, I mean, I'm making an assumption here, but I think from our prior chat, we'd spoken about orthorexia. A lot of the time when people talk about orthorexia, they say one of the biggest differences between anorexia and orthorexia is not that drive for thinness or that drive for weight loss. But I think you've made a really good point there in that it might not be the initial thing, but over time, naturally, as you said, with comments coming from society, I think anybody in that situation, if you're getting that positive reinforcement about the fact that you've lost weight. One thing I wanted to ask you, you know, if people get ill in somebody's family, you know, people are maybe, they're told that, I can't think of the word, it's like in their family to be
hereditary.
Hereditary, yeah.
Yeah.
Or they've got a higher likelihood of type 2 diabetes or something. People may change their diet, but then they don't maybe take it to the extremes that you did. Do you have any thoughts on why it became so restrictive?
Not until recently, and I'm talking within the last couple of months, somebody said to me, and this felt for me like the missing piece of the puzzle of understanding my orthorexia. They said, treat it as much as an eating disorder, as an obsessive compulsive disorder. And I was like, oh my gosh, for me, that explained everything, because I'd yet to meet somebody whose orthorexia wasn't just around food. My orthorexia went so much further than that. It was toiletries, it was household products, and it was medication. It was anything that I thought might make me sick. And because of the horrendous accounts that I'd been following on social media, the bashing of pharmaceuticals was a huge part of health back then. Naturally, to some degree, it still is now, isn't it? So there was no medication in my life, not even paracetamol. I wouldn't take anything like that. All of my toiletries were natural because I didn't want them to contaminate me from the outside in. And all of my household products are natural because I didn't want to be touching stuff around the house that had chemicals in it. Literally everything is a chemical. Like, I've learned so much now, but that was how, I guess if you want to say, brainwashed I'd become from the accounts that I'd followed. But understanding it as an OCD for me just answered everything, because OCD is very much like the consequences of what you think will happen if you don't do it. And that's what my whole life has centered around.
That's really interesting, actually, because I remember when orthorexia kind of got a bit more light a few years ago, I remember seeing a triangle diagram, and somebody was saying orthorexia, basically, if you had a triangle, you've got anorexia, OCD, and then orthorexia kind of sits in the middle of those. Is that kind of how you would describe it?
Yeah, I mean, I think most eating disorders are a form of OCD. It's, you know, still worrying about what the outcome's going to be, isn't it? And so, but absolutely. And then when orthorexia very often starts morphing into anorexia, yeah, it's all just a big muddle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's, they're all mechanisms, aren't there, to control those consequences that you fear so much. But actually, the deeper you get, the less you kind of have control over it. And in terms of your experience of orthorexia, what sort of impact did that have on your life?
Eating out was so difficult because vegan really wasn't a thing back then, especially not in restaurants. And so very often the only option you had when you ate out was chips. And then there was the thought of, but these could have been cooked in animal fat, so I can't even have that, which then leaves you to a salad. And I remember my auntie saying that she realized it was a huge problem. She lives in Cornwall, so we don't see her very often. We see her once or twice a year. We tried to go out for lunch in Loo once in Cornwall, and I just wouldn't eat anywhere. And it was causing me so much distress because everyone was just like, oh, fuck, just can you not just eat this just today? And it's like, no, you don't get it. I can't, because I will die. Like, if I eat this, I will die. So it's not just a case of, can't you just not be vegan today? Then my two dear friends, my best friends, tolerated so much because I wouldn't eat out. So I always cooked for them. They always came around. I always cooked for them. I made them eat chocolate avocado mousse and stuff like that. But like every time they came round, it was just stuff like that, like main course and pudding. And I just feel so sorry for them. I'm so grateful that they're still my friends because, yeah, just eating out was really difficult. But they were also amazing cooking for me. They were like my two people that I knew that I could trust. Mm. If somebody else was going to cook for me, it was going to be them.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think the biggest impact is eating out.
Yeah, I mean, I think like your eating in general is just so impacted. And from my experience of having anorexia, I think one thing I've realized in recovery is when you're in it, you don't realize how restrictive you've become, particularly if you're not going out and eating, or you're not going to friends and having food, you're eating for them. You can control the boundaries so, so much more. And, you know, I laughed when you said about the avocado chocolate mousse, and I'm not laughing at all because I know that like, the reasons why you were doing that obviously were how terrified you were. But I think back to some of the stuff I used to eat, I'm like, what the hell? Yeah. But I think it also shows you how brainwashed you are, because I genuinely believed that it was delicious, or it was normal, or it was okay to be eating like that.
Yes, that's really interesting that you say that, actually, because I convinced myself that I liked spirulina and wheatgrass, and it was like drinking soil, but you do train yourself to like it.
And you mentioned your friends, and I think one thing that is so important is the trust that you obviously had in them. And I suppose some people may think in that instance, if they had you for dinner and you said, I will only eat certain things, what would your thoughts be if they put something in there without telling you and then said to you later on, well, I put it in that there and you survived?
Oh, trust would be gone. Friendship would be over, like no doubt about it. I mean, even now with a logical head, I still think that would be the case. You know, when something means so much to you, even if it is an eating disorder, for your best friends to trick you like that, I don't think I could have forgiven that.
Because I think I completely agree with you. I don't think it's the right thing to do at all, because as you said, that trust is then gone. And when you're so scared of eating certain things because you genuinely think that you're going to die, doing that just completely shatters that trust. But I suppose some people may say, well, your friends shouldn't have just gone along with it, because then you were just staying stuck in your eating disorder.
Okay, I think it's really important for me to say here then, I was never diagnosed. I went to the doctors twice when I lost my period, and they said that my loss of period, my slow heart rate, my low blood pressure was all because I was an athlete and it should be expected. And because my body never naturally goes into underweight, no matter, like when I was at my lowest of my low, I was still just inside of healthy. on the BMI scale. So when I went to the doctors twice, it was never, my eating patterns were never even acknowledged. And I will say that back then, I think even if they had have been questioned, I think they'd have just been praised. I still don't think it would have been picked up. So 7 years I lived with this without knowing. And so I think if we knew that I was living with an eating disorder and my friends were trying to help me come out the other side, I think that would have been very different.
Yeah. And please don't think that I was trying to bash your friends there.
Oh my gosh, no, I didn't.
In the slightest.
No, I didn't. No, no, I didn't.
But unfortunately, I think as you've said, there is such a big kind of pull on all the behaviours that you've described, being dedicated, being motivated. You're able to say, no, I'm not having the cake, because you have the willpower to do that. And people will glorify those behaviours. So when you're actually going to the doctor and saying, I'm really struggling right now, and someone's just like, you're totally fine.
Yeah.
How can you go back and ask for help again?
Yeah. You can't. And like you say, you almost, I think especially with orthorexia, there is a, sounds quite shameful to say it now, but like a real feeling of superiority, that you, not only do you know the secret hack to health, but you have the discipline to stick to it. Mm. And when all of those other things are around that you think in your mind are unhealthy and everybody else can't resist them, or however you want to frame it, there is definitely a feeling of superiority, especially when people start coming to you for advice. And I, gosh, like the advice that I used to give out was horrendous, like awful. I was just spouting everything that I was seeing on social media. I should never have been giving out that advice.
And I think you see that so often, don't you? People that are calling themselves nutritionists or experts in the field of nutrition, and actually they're just sharing very disordered behaviours.
Yeah.
But if they've got a good following and they've got a nice physique, people will follow that and think that that's exactly what they have to do as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's scary. And it's not changing. It just looks different now. As in, like, you know, what's trending, but it's still the same crap.
Yeah, and I think that's what the scary thing is before I think it was quite obvious when it was diet chat, but now I think it's quite subtle and it is disguised under this film of health. And I know that, like, something else that you're super passionate about is talking about eating disorders during pregnancy. And I wondered, you know, does that passion come from having your own lived experience of that?
Yeah, it did. So in between getting my periods, I got pregnant. This was 3 years into my orthorexia. It was a really messy pregnancy. I have learned now that if you are living with an eating disorder, that you can be susceptible to hyperemesis. At 12 weeks, I developed hyperemesis. At this point in my disordered eating, the restriction was definitely there as well as the healthy eating. And my hyperemesis kept me very, very slim. I was 16, 17 weeks and I was still not showing at all. You would have no idea, but I was so poorly. But there was more light for me in the fact that I was still really slim. It is so messed up when you think about it, but I was in this cycle of, I'd be really sick for say 3 or 4 days. So I'd be in hospital for that time on a cocktail of anti-sickness and saline drips. And they would send me home with all of these different anti-sickness drugs. Well, obviously I had this block on medication, as in a mental block. And so I would go home and I wouldn't take them because I was too scared to take them. I was like, well, they pumped enough of it in me in hospital. I can't take it at home as well. So then I'd only end up home for a few days. And then I'd end up back in hospital again because I was really sick and I couldn't keep anything down. And when I say I couldn't keep anything down, my friend who is a midwife, who actually ended up delivering my little boy, she messaged me one day and she was like, how much have you kept down today? And it was about 5 in the evening. And I sent her this picture and there was just a, like, an inch of water taken from the top of the bottle. And that was all I'd kept down all day. And that was me throughout my pregnancy, really. So yeah, it was just this merry-go-round of in hospital, then back out, not taking the drugs, so ending up back in hospital again. And it was horrendous. And I have since learned that many people with eating disorders and disordered eating develop hyperemesis. I don't know what the link is, but yeah. And you can also have problems through labor, which I did. I was being sick throughout labor just because of like the surge of hormones. And my lovely friend who delivered Rex, who's my little boy, she was saying, you need to have some sweets to get your ketones down, because my ketones are really high. But sweets, again, I was like, they're not healthy, and it's gelatin. I can't eat gelatin because it's animal. So I would take them off her and I would chew them, and then I'd spit them out, and there were these piles of chewed up Skittles around the bath because I wouldn't eat them. And then delivery can, you know, be messy if you've lived with an eating disorder. The actual labor for me wasn't so bad, but the delivery was, well, I couldn't get Rex out. And he ended up being taken straight off me to be resuscitated. I didn't see him for the first 20 minutes. And that was really hard. On reflection now, to know that I probably played a huge part in that. His Apgar was 2 when he was born. When you have a baby, they're given an Apgar score when they're born, and then 10 minutes after. And his Apgar was 2. And my friend who delivered him said, I didn't think he was coming back. Like he wasn't alive when he came out. And that's, again, low Apgars are linked to eating disorders. There can be a number of reasons why you have a low Apgar, but an eating disorder is one of them. So that was like the labor. My friend said that you need to have a blood transfusion, as a lot of people do when they have a baby. I wouldn't do it because it was somebody else's blood contaminating my body. She said, right, we need to sort your iron out. We need to sort your blood count out. So you need to take these iron tablets and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Well, guess what? I wouldn't take the iron tablets. I said, do you trust me to do this myself? And because she was like one of my closest friends then, she knew that I would obsessively do this. So for the first 2 weeks of Rex's life, wasn't really focusing on him. I was just focusing on getting my iron up, because when you have orthorexia, your knowledge of like the health benefits from different foods is, it's weird, it's off the scale. And so I knew everything that I had to do to get my iron up, and I did it. And I'm not saying that as in I'm proud of it. I think it's actually, you know, really sad that that was what my focus was for the first 2 weeks. And then that was really my focus then for the first couple of years of being a mum, was making sure that I was still eating clean and make sure that I was getting my body back to the size that it was before, you know, dancer's body. And because I was still a full-time dancer then. So yeah, it wasn't fun, and it wasn't the way it should have been.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I think it just shows how consuming it can be, because, you know, what you said there about eating the Skittles, you still couldn't eat them in labor when your ketones were super high, you're giving birth. And I think that is such a powerful message to say just how all-consuming it is, because, I mean, my experience is very similar. Nothing else matters in the world than following the rules that basically have been set in your head.
Yeah. Yeah. It overrules everything, like absolutely everything. And people say to me, what was your turning point? And I feel awful in not saying it was Rex, because I was in it then. It wasn't until I met Jimmy, so 4 years ago, and that was when I realized that if I just focused on what I was eating, I was going to miss this amazing life that I knew could happen with him. So I had a choice and I chose Jimmy. And that's not to say that I didn't choose Rex. I think that's really important to say. Like, Rex has always been, you know, who I live and breathe for. But I didn't know that I was poorly. I think it's, again, like, just important to remember that I was never diagnosed. So I didn't know I was poorly until I knew I was poorly.
Did you find when you had Rex, did you have the same worries about him getting ill that you had for yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. I felt it for everybody. And I think that's, I think I was probably really annoying when I had nurse living with it, because I was always saying to people, that's going to give you cancer. You know, that's, do you not worry about your health? Do you not care about your health? Yeah. God, it's actually quite cringe now, but yes, definitely. And Rex's dad wasn't vegan. He was pescatarian. And I didn't want to be the only vegan. So as Rex grew up, I told Rex that we were vegan for ethical reasons, which it was a lie. I wasn't vegan for ethical reasons at all. But I tell you one thing I did do. I would go to extreme measures to make sure that I stayed vegan. So I would watch all of the ethical vegan documentaries so that I could get it into my head that I was doing the best thing for the animals. But it went so far, and my friends still call it this now, it went so far that I used to call cow's milk cow's pus so that I didn't drink it. And I used to call eggs chicken periods so that I wouldn't eat them. And my friends still call them that now as a joke to take the piss out of me. And I know now that that's hilarious. Those were the lengths that I would go to ensure that I wouldn't consume it. And so I told Rex that we were vegan for the animals. So Rex is 9 now, and he is autistic and ADHD. But he is very black and white thinking. For him, right and wrong, yes and no. And so for him, he is still vegan now for ethical reasons for the animals. And at the moment, it doesn't look like there's any chance of him coming away from that. He does get curious sometimes and he does ask questions. He knows that I eat animal products now and he knows my journey and he knows that I have to eat that to have a healthy relationship with food. And he knows that I now help other people do the same thing. And he's really understanding of that. But for him, it's still very black and white, you know, eating animals and animal products is wrong. He did ask questions about chickens. So we had the conversation around where they're not fertilized and that's how their eggs. And he was, you know, he's like, oh, which bit is the chick? And we said the yolk. And so we said, why don't you just try it in meringue? Because that's just the white bit. That's, you know, that wouldn't be the animal. So he took a little bit of, he took a little bite of meringue, but then he wouldn't eat the rest because he said he felt too guilty. And he saw me eating a cheese board last Christmas. And he said, Mama, when I'm older, I'm going to eat the cheese board as well. So there's hope there, but I still carry a lot of shame and a lot of guilt around the fact that he is that way and he carries the guilt because of what I did and said. And that's that. I think that will always be a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's so tricky, isn't it? Because as we've said, you were completely brainwashed by it. Yeah. And you were very ill. And as you said, you didn't know that you were ill. And it's so tricky because ultimately, at the end of the day, you were trying to protect him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all your intentions were absolutely the best for him. I don't know whether you find this, but I was the same. I went vegetarian. I told everyone it was for ethical reasons. Yeah, you know, now I actually, in my recovery, I went back to eating meat and I found it really, really uncomfortable, but I found it really uncomfortable from an ethical animal protection point of view. And I asked myself the question, you know, if there was a like vegan sandwich or a meat sandwich, but the vegan sandwich had more calories, which one would you have? And back in the day, my answer would have been absolutely the meat. Whereas my answer now will always be the vegetarian one. So for me, I think I've reached a point where I'm actually happy. And if I go on holiday and there's fresh fish and I want it, that's okay. I like to not live by rules. But that was a random tangent. I find it really difficult when people say that they're vegan or vegetarian for ethical reasons. I'm like, you're just lying to yourself. Like, you're just doing this to restrict. And so I guess in a bad way, I'm not never testing people, but I kind of like to see, well, if I got you a vegan cheese board, would you eat it? Because then that to me is like, if you ate the vegan one, then you're not doing it for restrictive reasons. Whereas if you won't eat it because it's cheese and you're scared of cheese, that's probably when the issue is. But I don't know whether you get that in sense of, in terms of, because your reason was not actually animal rights, if other people say that.
So I've gone back to eating fish, and it's you know, the main part of my diet. Cheese, cow's pus, whatever you want to call it, I'm all over it. I bloody love it, and I will eat it forever. I've not gone back to eating meat, not from an ethical reason, but from a texture reason. I don't, and I never did eat fake meat either. I went vegetarian when I was 22, and that had nothing to do with restriction. It was just because I just don't like the texture of meat, but I can eat fish. So I don't know, maybe if I challenged it, I probably could eat it, but it doesn't, I don't think it would bring me any joy, and it certainly doesn't excite me, the thought of it. But yeah, a fish platter, a cheese platter, I'm all over it.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? There are so many different reasons why people do go vegan or vegetarian that are completely, absolutely fine reasons. But I think it's really being able to check in with yourself and kind of know where your thoughts are coming from. Mm. And I know you've mentioned that you do eat so dairy products and fish now, but what did your recovery look like? If you never got that official diagnosis, how did you realize, shit, I need to do something?
Yeah, I realized how obsessive it was, really, and how it was the only thing that I thought about. Like, when you're vegan, having food prepared, especially if you're, you know, like I was, where everything had to be cooked from scratch, you basically spend your life in the kitchen. That's all you do. And then when I met Jimmy, and I was like, I want to do things with him. Like, Rex was young enough for me to still be in the kitchen all the time. But now, you know, he's that much older and he does need my attention. And so I had the conversation with Jimmy, and, you know, I said, yeah, I think that I may have been living with orthorexia. I was vegan, obviously, when me and Jimmy met. He's always been vegetarian. So I didn't feel like I had a huge step to make, didn't have to go from vegan to meat eating. And the easiest thing for me to introduce first was eggs. I don't know why specifically, but that felt like the easiest thing. And then the next thing was salmon, because that was the thing that I missed the most. And then it was onto all of the shellfish. And then the last thing, which was probably only about 18 months ago, was cheese and yogurt. Yeah, dairy products, really. That was my biggest fear, was dairy. And then, yeah, like I say, last Christmas was the first cheese board. Oh my gosh, I was like, I can't believe I've been missing out on this for like 10 years. So yeah, I don't really think there was ever a ding, my gosh, I have an eating disorder, but it was this consumes my whole life and I don't think that's right, and I want to put my attention elsewhere. And then obviously healing my relationship with food has made it blindingly obvious in neon lights that it was an eating disorder.
And I guess, did you have kind of the dual recovery of, by that point, I assume that with the restriction creeping in, you've got that element of recovery that's very difficult, but then also, you know, your fears around getting ill, or which actually, sorry to just, that's actually just thought in my head. You know how you said you were super ill during your pregnancy? Did you ever think, am I ill because I'm not eating?
No. I just, you know, I knew that people got hyperemesis. Whenever I said to anybody, oh, I've been in hospital with hyperemesis, they were like, oh, like Princess Kate. And I was like, yeah. Because she's really the only person that, well, especially then, that we knew about it, because she was always in the news with it, wasn't she? In her pregnancies, she's had hyperemesis with every child. But no, never. And I tell you something, which I wish health professionals in pregnancy, so like midwives and stuff, maybe questioned a little bit more. because they knew that I wasn't taking my medication. They were like, oh, well, that's why you're back in here. I remember Rex's daddy coming into my room, my hospital room one day, because I was always put on a ward in a room on my own, which I was really grateful for, actually. He came into the room with two big bottles of green smoothie. And my consultant happened to be in there at the time. And he just said to me, you're not drinking any of that. That is out of your pregnancy. I need you on high sugar stuff, obviously, because my ketones were so high. He's like, I need you on Ribena. I need you on Fanta. I need you on sweets. And can you imagine the distress that caused? It was just like, in my head, I was like, why are you trying to kill me? Why are you trying to make me poorly? Like, these things aren't healthy. These things aren't going to help my child. But I couldn't keep the green smoothies down. Like, I think he knew what was happening, but it was just never questioned and it was never flagged up. And I don't know. I know that they've got a lot of people to see, but, you know, maybe be a bit more curious.
Yeah, no, I think I get that there's a lot of people to see. There's not a lot of resources and there's not a lot of funding. But ultimately, by not taking that time, you are making things worse and you're giving yourself more work because people just end up getting more and more poorly. And, you know, that conversation could have been so different in terms of that's probably not actually what you need right now. You know, maybe we could try other things or, you know, what is your pull to these things rather than having things that are actually going to support your pregnancy and doing that in a really compassionate way rather than, oh my God, no, not having that. And you need to have this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure also if the time had been taken when saying you need to have Ribena, Fanta, sweets, blah, 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 there would have been absolute fear in your eyes. So I am sure that kind of energy could have been picked up on and maybe just inquired a little bit more about, you know, is that okay with you? How do you feel? Is there any extra support that we could give you with that?
Yeah. And then also, you know, with the iron thing, it wasn't just my friend. There were other midwives there and they were all like, are you really going to do this on your own? I was like, yeah, watch me. And I did. And obviously I was tested to check my iron levels. Again, nobody questioned anything.
And I just can't understand why there's no questioning in terms of why are your ketones so high? Like, what are you eating? Was that ever a question that was asked?
No. And they also would keep me in. So once the sickness had subsided, because I was on the cocktail and I was on the saline drip, they would keep me in for like another day or so because my blood pressure was so low. Well, my blood pressure was so low because of the restriction. And because my doctor had told me, like before I was pregnant, that it was fine for my blood pressure to be this low because I was an athlete, I would just reiterate it back to them. I would just say, well, then I'm going to have to live here because my blood pressure is just naturally low. And it's not naturally low because it's not naturally low now. So, yeah, I think there can be so much more curiosity around pregnancy and outside of pregnancy, just eating habits and just not making it about weight, because that's why I slipped through the net. And just asking somebody and just getting curious about how much it's consuming their mind and how much it's dictating their behaviors and how much of an impact it's having on their social life and their work life. Just ask those questions, because that's a much bigger indicator than where you sit in the BMI scale.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I think that, you know, pregnancy is a vulnerable time for people. If you've struggled with disordered eating or body image before, or maybe even if you haven't, your body goes through quite a lot of changes. And equally, I think a lot of people are worried about, you know, having the best nutrition or eating in the best way to support their baby. So to me, I can't comprehend why there's not more nutritional support or those check-ins, as you've just mentioned. You know, all of that added up as well, the hormonal shifts. Like, we know the massive hormonal shifts that impacts your mood, it impacts your emotions. Like, I would be thinking that people would be getting weekly check-ins on how's your eating going? How's your mood? Like, is everything feeling okay? Because I can imagine there's a lot of turbulences and a lot of worries, as well as it being, you know, people say a lovely period, for a lot of people, I can imagine it's actually a very stressful one.
Yeah, it is, especially if you have body and food issues. You're watching your body changing like daily, and that's really scary. I danced, you know, right up until he was born, in between the times that I was out of hospital, just because I wanted to do everything I could to try and keep my body in shape. And yeah, I was back to dancing when he was 10 weeks old full time. It just felt important to me to get my body back. So yeah, I think they're all, like you say, it would just be really good just to have a holistic check-in, you know, even if it was every 2 weeks, just how are you doing? Not how's the baby doing, because that's what all of your appointments are for, but how are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And to finish on maybe a positive note, not that it's not been positive, because I think you've given loads of incredible strategies there for people. And I really hope people do listen. And, you know, if they could, that's something they can use in their practice, fantastic. But if somebody's listening and they're pregnant right now and struggling, what would your advice be?
Reach out to the people that you trust. If you feel like you can be honest, because it's really hard to be honest when you're living with an eating disorder. If you feel like you can be honest, share with them what it is that's worrying you and ask them from a logical point of view, do you think this is right? Do you think this is a normal worry to have? Or do you think maybe I might need some support? And, you know, speak also to your perinatal team and see if there's something that they've come across before. And if they have or haven't, I'm a really big advocate for, if you can afford specialized eating disorder private care, then do, because we're so limited. Like, our NHS are incredible, but they're so limited at what they can offer. When a lot of healthcare is being gatekept because of your BMI, you might not get the support that you need anyway. And so if you can even just have a consultation with somebody, you know, like an eating disorder therapist, if you can have just a consultation and just talk through, you know, your little red flags that you think, oh, I wonder if this is a problem or if it's not. I wonder if I have orthorexia or if I am just a healthy person. Just put those worries to bed by speaking to somebody.
Yeah.
And that is easier said than done, because that does mean admitting, you know, something that you might not want to admit.
Yeah. But I always think, if you've got it in the back of your mind that something might be going on, then that probably means it is. And also, sometimes I think if you're thinking, is there something going on here? It might also be your brain saying, it's kind of a little cry for help of, can we change something here? So even though it does feel incredibly difficult, but I think that's why, like you said, you know, talking to somebody that you trust, and then, you know, maybe it's that you speak to a friend or a family member, then maybe they can come with you to speak to a healthcare professional if you don't want to do that all on your own as the first person that you tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Zoe. It's honestly been so lovely to chat to you, and I appreciate you sharing your story so much. Where can people go to find out more about you?
You can find me on Instagram at Light Minds Collective, my website, www.lightmindscollective.com. Or I'm on LinkedIn as well as Zoe Harwood. Thank you so much for having me and letting me share my story and giving orthorexia a voice as well.
Absolutely. We are here for giving everybody a voice. So yeah, I really appreciate you sharing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.